Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by David Salomon, the CEO of General Biotics. Hi, David.
Hi, hi, Christopher.
David?
We're calling you Kelly.
Yeah. And we're laughing because I botched his name in the original introduction, but we'll go with this one because I know that if I do it again, it won't be right. So David is a computer scientist, so a man after my own heart. I've got a degree in computer science, but that's not what he's focused on right now. He's the CEO of a new probiotic company, and the name of the probiotic is called Equilibrium. And I'm excited to have him on the show today because this is a different sort of product. I've never seen anything like this before. And so David, why don't you start by telling us a bit about the probiotic? What problem did you see, and what opportunity do you think exists?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So, just to give you a little bit more background here, it's computer science, but most of it's been statistics and machine learning.
Right.
Which is to say that sort of bioinformatics and that sort of stuff has been a passion of mine. I've been volunteering as an adjunct faculty at San Diego State University, which has a really phenomenal sort of microbiome program. We've got Forrest Rower down there, who's sort of one of the big names. And from this bioinformatics stuff, there's been a lot of really interesting discoveries, which I'm sure a lot of people have read about here, about sort of human digestion and how it links to health and how it's sort of much more important and much more complex than we previously sort of viewed it as. I think that's sort of how I got into this. Was sort of hanging around these people, hearing sort of these crazy stories about these magnificent correlations with, it's this sort of cluster of microbes. And yes, so that's sort of what got me into it, these crazy studies. The premise for the probiotic is that basically our gut, the actual microbial makeup of our stomach, is not particularly stable. You get a lot of the microbes from your parents, but the actual makeup of them, right, the way that they're structured and the way that they all sort of work together is supposed to, in a natural environment for an evolved human, supposed to come from the diet. You're going to get this constant influx of microbes. The microbes are essentially the things that are already digesting the food you eat. Some of these will not be ones that are happy digesting food that you give them. But some of them will be happy becoming domesticated. And in a tribe of people, you'll get ones applied by your comrades, which are ones that are symbiotic, right?
Right.
Basically, everyone's coated in a bunch of symbiotic microbes. In a modern society, we've taken great steps to remove these microbes. And that's because stuff like E. coli and salmonella grow, and as we've begun producing food in sort of very impressive and awesome quantities, well, you get the pathogen problem. So the solution to the pathogen problem has been to just sterilize everything, right?
Right.
So the 0.1% or whatever of microbes that are just truly horrific, the solution is to kill them all. And at least the data that Beltran was showing me before we founded the company, and then the data we've got after founding and sort of giving sort of our solution to a bunch of people, it basically has me convinced that that's the central error, is that sort of humans evolved to receive a lot of dietary microbes, and we've removed them.
Okay. So the product is actually an offshoot of the NIH's Human Microbiome Project, which I thought was really interesting. I actually did the samples. We sent those in, and I've been doing, I think it's in collaboration with the University of Colorado, have been doing a training course, which I think might have ended now. But yeah, go check that out. I'll put some links in the show notes, see if you can find that. So can you tell me a bit about that project and how it helped you formulate a probiotic?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different, I think you might be talking about, is it the American Gut Project?
Or oh, yeah. Am I getting the two things confused?
No. So Beltran did his postdoctoral work at the Human Microbiome Project, which is, that's one of the big ones. The American Gut Project and Ubiome are two big ones trying to get basically a humongous census. Right. So Human Microbiome Project did, I think, 213 sort of closed sequences, which is you basically take a sample and you sequence every single microbe.
Right.
And that's it. So here's the full DNA. Stuff like the American Gut Project, stuff like Ubiome, which a lot of people are using, those guys do 16S sequencing. So that's there's this small region of DNA that happens to mutate a lot. And you can sort of use that to do typing.
Okay.
So very different approaches. Yeah. So basically, if you're looking to figure out what kind of microbes we should be eating, if we're going to do that in a satisfying way, you could do two ways, right? You could do it the way that Eli, I've never pronounced his name, Metchnikoff, the gentleman that sort of was responsible for coming up with the premise of probiotics, did it, which was he looked around, he was like, oh, okay, these guys seem to be eating a lot of microbes and they seem healthy, right? So that's a pretty good idea that maybe those are the good microbes to eat. And the other way is to actually look and go, okay, well, here's metabolic function for a very healthy human, right? Here's exactly what it should look like. And metabolic function here means, turns glucose into, but it's like, here's an actual metabolic pathway, right? Here's in your stomach. If you put glucose in, here's what's going to happen. Here's what the microbes are going to do to it. Probably a better example that I know is true is the construction of folic acid. So that's basically how it became an offshoot is we have the data, right? We've got here's what an unhealthy gentleman in Colorado looks like. Here's what a sort of very exceptionally healthy person in New York looks like. Here's what a medium healthy person in Arizona looks like. We have that data. We have access to that data because of this $115 million science project that is aptly funded.
And then, so how do you know? How do they know which is the cause and which is the effect? Then, so we've established that this is the flora belonging to a healthy person, and then the opposite is true too. So, how do you know which is the cause and which is the effect?
So there's some extent to which the someone's general health can cause microbes. There's also a sense to which, like, the microbes themselves, I don't know if you've been reading this, but it's been freaky, basically can cause you to be sort of excited about eating different foods, and that's going to change your microbial makeup. So hunger mediated through microbes. Both of those are true. Basically, in a modern environment, you're not going to – the sources of additional microbes are, first of all, limited. And second of all, you've got like on a single micro level, you could say, okay, here's what it's producing. So you can look at the microbe, you can look at the DNA, and you could say, okay, well, here's what it codes for.
Right.
So it's fairly easy in some cases to go like, well, that's a parasite, right? Like that thing's not.
Okay.
Right. So we've got a list of pathogens. We've got a list of like, oh, well, maybe that stuff's useful. And then we've got like the list of stuff where. So a really famous example is the ones that we think basically cause peanut allergies.
Okay, I was completely unaware of this.
Oh yeah, so there's a couple microbes. In fact, I think there's one canonical one they use for the studies, which can cure peanut allergies in mice.
Okay,
I can send you a link to. For some of them, it's just sort of. Easy in the sense that like that thing on its own, if you're doing sort of like a Fisher style experiment, you could just say, okay, yeah, that one's extremely good. For some of them, you can't. For some of them, you're just sort of like, you're looking at it and you're like, well, this one's much less diverse than that one. So like just on a pure diversity scale, there's a disconnect. Why would you want diversity? Diversity is extremely important because they basically regulate each other. If you're worried about having like a bacterial overgrowth, or you're worried about, if you're looking at, and I should pause here because I've just talked about a bunch of diseases and I'm going to explain how this stuff connects to equilibrium stuff, but I'm not trying to say you're going to get cured from peanut allergies if you take it. We don't have those microbes in there because that's, that's more of a long-term goal. We want to establish safety before we put that stuff in, but I should have premised the entire this entire discussion with that. So that's me being a beginner.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So yeah. So what's changed is this technology has come along and enabled us to identify these different microbes that live in our gut. And we've established that some of them do us some good and then some of us do us some harm. And then basically you've figured out the difference between the entire community of microbes, between that of a healthy person and an unhealthy person. And then so how does equilibrium, how does the probiotic come in to close that gap? Is that even possible? It must be, else the product wouldn't exist, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so just to sort of do a recap of what I attempted to explain. Yeah, some are just known to be horrible. Some are just known to be awesome. But in general, positive health outcomes seem to be correlated with highly diverse microbiomes. And that's because you can't get destabilization from a pathogen, right? It's much harder to, like, potato famine happens just in Ireland. That happens because all of the potatoes are the same kind, so a single blight can come along and it can wipe them out.
Right.
If you instead have fields that none of them contain the same potatoes, you can't get a plague that knocks them out, right? So just from a from like an evolutionary pesticide perspective, you want diverse potatoes and you want diverse microbes inside your gut. So a very healthy human's gut, perhaps, I think it's 1,400 strains, depending on how you're defining what a strain is in like a Hadza tribes member, and it's maybe about 1,000 strains for someone in the U.S. There's a gap there. And as people go down, I know we were looking at ulcerative colitis in children. Basically, if you catch ulcerative colitis and you've got about 100 strains in your gut, you're not gonna be curable with current methods. And if you've got around 500 strains in your gut, you are curable with current methods. So again, not trying to talk of cures, but I think basically all the good science here happens to deal with disease. So that if I'm talking about studies, if I'm trying to keep it evidence-based, yeah. So yes, how is it that we can construct what a healthy person, what a healthy gut microbiome is from the data? That's the question. And what we were, okay, so we became convinced that there was sort of a nutritional deficit going on, that basically if we're looking at the Hadza and we're looking at humans or we're looking at sort of indigenous people in Puerto Rico, which you have got phenomenal data on because basically someone has been devoting their entire career to sequencing indigenous people in South Africa and their ancestors, because you can use coprolites, which is fossilized feces, to figure out, okay, well, that's what the microbiome looks like over there. And there's also some nice Australian indigenous people. So what you could do is you could try to infer, like, well, what kind of bacteria and viruses and microbes, like yeasts, what are these people getting in their diet that modern humans no longer get? And that's not enough of a question, right? Because undoubtedly they're getting some horrible stuff in their diet. But more specifically, what kind of microbes were they getting in their diet that, first of all, we actually think are likely beneficial? And we basically take that as, okay, well, it has a metabolic pathway that's likely to be beneficial, which is broadly it appears in healthier samples. Healthier people from these data sets we've got. And two, can we also locate modern people that eat them? And that's a safety concern, right? Can we find some, rural individuals who are in fact consuming this microbe? So okay. That's the basic approach, right? Is trying to find stuff that we're supposed to eat, using data to find what we're supposed to eat. And then, if it looks sort of safe, safe for consumption, then it seems like a good thing to include, right?
Okay. Yeah. So you think it's important then these people are actually consuming microbes rather than just eating foods that are creating the environment for the microbes to grow. Which is more important, or are they both important?
Equilibrium is it's a nutritional supplement. So if we're going to if we're going to make a nutritional supplement, like, I mean, people do FMT, people do sort of bacteria therapy stuff for diseases all the time. And I think that is tremendously important, right? If you get C. difficile infection, or you get H. pylori, you get stuff. Well, H. pylori. Anyway, if you get a disease, I think shifting the fundamentals probably through sort of strong invasive therapy. I think that's tremendously important. I think if you're just talking like nutrition stuff, I think it is quite important to maintain the balance there. Of course, like if you're taking antibiotics or something because you caught a disease, I mean, obviously that's more important than keeping your gut flora healthy, depending on what it was. If you just had a light fever, or you had the flu or something, probably not worth taking antibiotics, although your doctor probably thinks that too. I think if we're just talking about keeping a normal, healthy person with good gut flora, I think basically no one's talking about how do we get our nutritional flora up. The existing probiotics are basically yogurt extracts and or bread extracts, right? It's one to two strains. It's very questionable whether or not our ancestors consumed them. For instance, if you go to the Hadza, they don't have ovens, so.
Okay.
Anyway, it's not like advanced bread making. The yeast connection is questionable. If you are looking at like evolutionary nutrition type stuff, milk's a pretty recent invention. So, but I think both of those are sort of questionable choices for microbial supplementation.
Okay, so these questionable choices are the microbes that are in the sort of common store-bought probiotics that you might see in the refrigerated section of your local supermarket. And then, so how are the microbes in equilibrium differently? How did you select them?
Sure, yeah, I mean, it's you basically, so we started with sort of what are the large deltas that you can see if you look at, say, a Hadza, or say, Puerto Rican sample, and then you use those to figure out, okay, well, is there a dietary connection? What are the dietary microbes? Basically, the criteria selection is sort of err on the side of caution with respect to anything that looks like a pathogen. So there's some interesting studies, and again, I should premise this with, Beltran's the one to ask for most of these studies, but there's some interesting studies on C. difficile actually sort of helping people with asthma, in the sense that if you look at a 2-year-old and they've got a colonization by C. difficile, they're less likely to have asthma as an adult. But that one's also sort of known as a pathogen, so that one's you don't go with that one.
Okay.
Even if there's a correlation, there's a risk there, right? But if we're just talking a general microbe, if we're just talking like, okay, we've managed to locate some people in a rural environment who are consuming it, and it seems like sort of pretty present in modern society and definitely present in sort of an ancestral microbiome, we say, green light. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But you must have had so many different organisms to choose from. How did you narrow it down to just, there's 115 different species in equilibrium, right?
Yeah. And I mean, depending on how, so like the 1000 number and the 1400 number that I quoted earlier, if you go to OTUs, which is a pretty used metric in sort of microbiology today, well, you could justify that there's sort of 10,000 strains, let's say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's a hard question which ones to go in. Future versions, we're hoping to take the strain count up to, say, 500 or 350. Or Beltran's going to kill me for talking numbers here.
So Beltran, I should say, is the chief science officer at General Biotics.
Yep.
But, you're doing a great job.
Okay, good. So the main thing that you want to look at if you've got a limited number of strains, and I really want to impress upon you that 115 strains is not that's not a lot to work with if we're talking sort of keeping a gut microbiome healthy. The main thing you use is metabolic function. So if you already have a strain that basically does X, well, we need a strain that does Y instead, right? You don't want to include 15 different strains that all do X.
Right.
Yeah, so it basically, it's sort of, you're not going to be able to get sort of a complete metabolic function for human microbiome in 115 strains, but you can sort of try to get the span, and you can go, okay, well, you know, which ones sort of vanish? And that's a lot of what you do when you're doing a delta between an unhealthy person and a healthy person, is you're sort of looking at where the disconnect, where the lack of coverage is in terms of ability to digest. But you could also be looking at, like, okay, this microbe's producing something horrifically unhealthy. But that basically is the definition of a pathogen. So that was really, yeah.
Okay, so just to summarize, we've got this NIH project that's identified these microbes, these small organisms that live in our gut, and we figured out which are the good guys, which are the bad guys, and we figured out the differences between a healthy person and an unhealthy person. And so now you're in a really great position to where you can look at these different microbes and say, okay, I want this one, and this one in my probiotic. But how does that become like a practical concern, right? So I'm sure there must be, like, you know, some of these microbes, maybe they're anaerobes, and so you can't grow them in a environment with oxygen. So how did that cross over? Like, were you limited on what you could choose based on how practical it was to put it into a product?
So I mean, bigger practical concerns are, like the plant count anomaly, which is to say that there's a lot of microbes that we sort of can't culture, grow. And I mean, so like anaerobic, well, that we have methods, right? It's anaerobic chamber. And a lot of microbes, you can sort of look it up. You can, okay, well, you know, here's, it almost seems like, sort of old witchcraft recipe, right? One drop of, brain blood infusion, one drop of this, one drop of that. But yeah, it definitely, we would appreciate, if society knew how to grow more microbes, that's definitely true. And the answer is, you know, if you can't grow it, you can't use it. So, it's unfortunate, but yeah, there's no sort of way around not being able to grow something.
Okay. And I wanted to talk to you about, I know you can't tell me which microbes are in this probiotic, which has been causing some controversy, right? What's the state of that? Why is that? And is that likely to change in the future?
Okay. So basically, if we're going to get sort of funding to do, well, it's essentially prescription probiotic development, which is what Beltran's quite passionate about. That's sort of one of the things I'm quite passionate about is like that, the ulcerative colitis thing I was quoting earlier. We want to go after that, right? We think, like, if you've got clear data, I can send you the paper over, or send you the papers over, talking about these sort of strain counts as determining health outcomes for treatment, right, for the current treatment methods. If we're going to manage to get funding to do that, it can't sort of be something that you can just clone, right? To go through an FDA trial, you basically need to own the stuff at the end if you're going to get funding for that. So just for the perspective of figuring out how to sort of protect the IP, doing a full disclosure is how you don't have patentability.
Okay.
So
interesting. Yeah. So how is that likely to change in the future then? Are you ever going to get to the point where you can say what's in it?
Yeah. I think we definitely will be able to get to the point where we can disclose it. The question is, figuring out which paperwork needs to be filed with which bureaucracy first, such that ownership.
Okay. And then, so tell me about the manufacturing process. I'm quite interested in that. The whole thing is designed here in California, but where is it manufactured?
Sure. Yep. So we've got a lab down in San Diego, which is sort of close to the SDSU bioinformatics lab I was describing to you before. It's being done in small batches. We're small. I don't know if you've ever seen sort of freeze-dried microbes, but gram is... that's 10 years supply or something, right? That's an incredible number. It's way more than 10. A gram is basically a dose is like the tip of a pin.
Right.
So it's actually sort of produced in the way that you'd produce microbes in a microbiology lab, right? We sat down, we here's the sample. And then we proceeded to grow all 115 strains ourselves in a microbiology lab down in San Diego.
Oh, wow. So this is a really, really small facility then. It's not like you just phoned somebody up in China and said, hey, I need these. Is that's not possible?
Yeah, and we wouldn't have phoned someone up in China because basically, if you start investigating how to manufacture probiotic, one of the conclusions you're going to come to is be very sure about the lab conditions for that probiotic. That's how companies get sued. That's how companies die. You want to be really sure that there's no contamination there.
Okay.
Yeah. And that, like, the microbe that you're buying is actually the microbe that you're getting. It's sort of, if you've ever tried to source bulk ingredients, the same issue comes up. Okay. Right. Okay, great. Thank you for the white powder, sir. Right. Yeah.
I get it. So tell me about the viability of the probiotic. I sometimes wonder about that. So we've gone through the manufacturing process and the powder is in the pill. What are the chances of that organism still being viable by the time I get it and I'm ready to take it?
Another interesting question is if it is viable and if there becomes moisture in the pill, it can reproduce in the pill and it can sort of evolve in the pill. So I think those are both concerns. Basically, if you freeze dry a microbe, that thing lasts. Microbes, you really can engage in cryonics on microbes. It's one of the few organisms. We are conservative with our expiration dates. So, we list them as 3 to 4 months, depending on how gloriously we think we did the packaging that time. We freeze dry the microbes before placing them into the capsules. It works, I guess. I wish I understood sort of more about sort of why it works, but I mean, it sort of demonstratively works. It sort of, yeah.
Okay.
You freeze dry.
And then, so have you looked at all at how many of these microbes are actually making it into the gut? Do you have any information about that, or is it not known?
Definitely. They're making their way to the gut. Whether or not on a given day you're going to get sort of that microbe is going to take or that sort of stuff. That's gambling. But in aggregate, if you're taking it over the course of, let's say, a week or a month, they're making it. Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know. And then tell me about the clinical trial. So there is a clinical trial underway, right?
Not a clinical trial is that's code for treating of disease.
Okay.
So there's a placebo-controlled double blind experiment underway. Yes.
Ah, okay. So tell me about the experiment.
Sure. Yeah. So it's we've got two populations of people. One are receiving essentially every single thing that's in equilibrium except for the microbes. So that's a delayed release capsule and some ground organic flax. The other group is receiving the same thing, but with our microbes added. They're answering a variety of daily questions, which cover things like mood, cover things like energy level, cover basically stuff the core, like you might, if you were giving someone, hey, does my new diet work, right? Does eating, a full serving of, or 5 servings of fruit and vegetables per day help you? It's those kinds of questions. And we also have questions like, what does your stool look like? Did you have a bowel movement today? But they're sort of basic questions, right? They're sort of questions you might want to know if you wanted to know if you should take the product, basically. It's almost a marketing study. You could call it a study designed for the purposes of demonstrating that the product works.
Okay. And how's that been going? Is that still ongoing at the moment?
Yes. Yeah. No, we have. That's slightly nightmarish in terms of sort of getting it to the finish line. But yes, that's ongoing. I don't know if you caught this, but we announced that we're going to be open sourcing the tools that we're using for the experiment.
Oh, cool. No, I didn't know.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so we actually think that, okay, so first of all, like this version is, it's just one version, right? It's not, I think anyone that produces something could, sees a variety of different things they want to do for the next version. So this study is going to stand for maybe 6 months or something before we're going to have to replace it when we release V2. I think that's actually going to be a broad concern. I think there's going to be a lot more sort of biotech startups that come out and they're wanting to prove stuff, right? I think there's also a lot of existing companies. So, you see a productivity tool and the productivity tool says, install this app and you're going to be 10% more productive. It would be nice if those people also had some demonstration. And I think the reason why we're not seeing this more often is because basically the cost of a study is tremendously high. So if you have to treat it very seriously and it's, you know, it's a six-figure study, you know, small startups never going to do it. So, you know, in our case, you know, we know how to do a study. And I think that's the thing that's blocking the productivity tools, is they don't know how to do the study. So it's called Prove It For Real. It's still sort of very early, but we're doing sort of calls for participation. We've got a couple PhDs from Berkeley on board. We've got a couple PhDs from Yale that may or may not be on board. PhDs and grad students, I should say. And we've got some folks from the Quantified Self that are excited about it. We're basically just making easy to use ways of automatically running experiments. And that's the method that we've been using for this experiment. And, you know, like any first user of our own product, it's been slightly nightmarish, but hopefully soon it will be less nightmarish and you can just sort of use it if you're looking to test some stuff.
Okay. And then, yeah. So what have the results been like? Like, how have the answers to the questions that you've been asking people that are taking the probiotic changed from those that haven't?
Sure. Yes. The results will come out soon. I shouldn't. Beltred would like literally kill me. But obviously, it's not far afield of the pilot study that we did. My girlfriend and I were some of the first people that took the product. I don't have post meal stomach pain. I never have. She did. She takes it every day because it sort of helps remove the stomach pain. In my case, I feel sort of more energetic. Those are the kind of things that we're going to demonstrate. But yeah, announcing results ahead of the study results is bad. But we do have the pilot study results on the website, and those are, of course, real results.
Excellent. So the place to find you then, generalbiotics.com. And you can order the product online, which is kind of cool. It drop ships direct. So I'm never going to be seeing this in the supermarket. Is that correct?
You may see it. It's just a question of, yeah, what sort of production ramp up looks like and if we can work out better ways of storing it. We kind of like the idea of going directly to consumers, honestly, or going directly through nutritionists.
Right.
Those ones seem better. It kind of feels like if the person's not receiving sort of good advice about eating in an evolutionary manner and that sort of stuff, they should. It feels like there's a complete lack of information on diet. So finding good nutritionists and selling through them seems extremely reasonable.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's where we fall in, I suppose. So it's not, you know, we're using your probiotic as part of a protocol that consists of a lot of diet and lifestyle coaching. And so, yeah, no one thing is just enough on its own, but all the individual pieces can be important. So yeah. That's great. So it sounds like this story is still evolving very rapidly and maybe we'd have to get you back on and talk some more about what's been going on and where you're at right now.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I mean, it is. It's small. We've got awesome people involved, but it's not. I think like you hit this point where a company will stabilize, right? So, my past software gigs, we're in the process of building the business, right? We built the product, but the business needs to be constructed quite badly. Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today, David. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Christopher. That's great.